This is Mental, the podcast to destigmatize mental health. I'm Bobby Temps.
I'm Danny Hogan.
Each Thursday, we delve into a factor or condition that influences the mind and how to better manage it. With special guests and stats you can trust, here we go. This week, we're talking all about bullying with Mark Simon. He's a writer and storyboarding expert with a very personal story to share. Before that, we've got a definition from bullying.co.uk, which states that there is no legal definition of bullying. However, it is usually defined as repeated behaviour which is intended to hurt someone, either emotionally or physically, and is often aimed at certain people because of their race, religion, gender, sexual orientation, or any other aspect, such as appearance or disability. So I found that a good all-encompassing definition for bullying, in particular what it mentioned about repeated behaviour, because that can be a slightly difficult distinction when it's one of these many things where you think, oh, I could instantly define that, and then you try and do it and you're like, oh, I'm not quite sure the words. That really any kind of act of harm could be considered bullying, but it's an ongoing thing.
Yeah, I guess it's just tricky though, isn't it? I would have thought that you can bully somebody once. You know, you can bully in terms of intimidate, abuse, you know, like somebody could come at me and try and, I would think, you know, try and get me to do something or bully me into doing something, like do it. You know, really bully me into it, but it may not happen again. Well, it won't when I tell them to not do it again. But you know what I mean? It's tricky because in the dictionary, the definition is repeated. However, we do see isolated incidents of bullying, don't we?
I see what you're saying. I still kind of disagree. And you even said in one of your examples there, someone trying to get you to do something, sort of repeatedly asking you. Do it. So, you know, so
in a one-time thing. So I guess that is repeated then.
Right. I guess that's where it's then like a weird grey area. Like if it's repeatedly in the same day, it probably still counts. Whereas to some people that wouldn't seem repeated. But I think it's an important distinction because there's all kinds of acts of bad intent that people make towards each other. They need to be taken very seriously, but bullying is an additional layer where the repeated nature can have further consequences for people. And as we'll hear when Mark shares his story, the ongoing nature was a major part of how in fear him and his family felt. So if it's happened a few times, you're then expecting it to happen again.
Absolutely. In general, of course, it's that repeated, you know, I was bullied would suggest that there's a regular occurrence. He bullied me into doing something. It's just language, I guess, and how we say things. But yeah, in general, it's you know, that repeated act of that somebody's feeling like repeatedly bullied, I guess. We can cut this out, maybe, Pete. But whatever, we're getting, but yeah, I'm shutting up now. Well, if I was more confident and able to use, you know, I've got adverbs and verbs written on the back of my wall from doing homeschooling. So if I was more confident, then I guess I'd use those words to describe what I mean. Yeah. You know what I mean? I was bullied. I am being bullied. Whatever. Move on.
Okay. So next up, we've got a few stats. And the first one is from Young Minds, who report that bullying affects 1 million young people every year. Which is such a massive number. Although actually when doing my own maths on it and looking at, you know, the population of people of schooling age, that equates to about 1 in 10. And in my own anecdotal experience, and maybe this is a reflection of the schools I've been to, I've found it to be much higher than 1 in 10 people have experienced bullying.
Yeah, that's interesting. I feel 1 in 10 is still huge.
Yeah, I mean, a million, but I'm not downplaying that at all. But it makes me think there's already so, so many people being affected. And I wonder if it's actually even more.
Absolutely. Years ago, when I was at school, 10 years ago, bullying, there was such a small description, or not description, but, you know, if you were bullied, somebody may have been taking your pocket money, or somebody may have been throwing you around in the grass. Now, again, and I know I talk about this a lot, and I absolutely love social media for so many reasons, but with social media and the fact that now we have got constant connection to people, the amount of bullying and the amount of ways people get bullied is the reach is just far wider.
Yeah, I know what you mean. And there's this concept people talk about of 24-hour bullying nowadays, that there was a point where you would go home from school and then that's the end of it, potentially. Maybe you'd get it around your local area a bit, but once you're in your own home, perhaps. Whereas now, you know, it can be any time, day or night. You can log onto your phone and read mean comments if they're there to be read. And we can just imagine how much more the impact can be. You know, if you don't have that stabilizing home to go and be your safe space anymore because the bullying is following you, how much more the impact on your mental health could be.
Absolutely.
And we see that time and time again in stories in the news of how bad people's mental health can be, you know, and how things can escalate in terms of self-harm or feeling suicidal. It's quite clear to see why, right? When you've got potentially as far as encouragement coming at you from social media.
Yeah, and that's why it's so brilliant that cyberbullying has become a thing, you know, and a prosecutable. See, I'm no good today,
but I'm losing all your words. So I think what you mean to say is not necessarily that it's become a thing, but it's become something definable and that we can take action on.
Yeah, because even when the internet and social media, you know, first came about, it would have been happening. But until it happened so much and so many people reporting it, it then became something that actually let's look into. And that's brilliant. I'd like to really see more increased awareness around bullying that is psychological bullying on isolation as well, because I think a lot of kids are left out of groups or are not spoken to and, you know, aren't always aware. Through people that I've spoken to as well, that, you know, bullying doesn't have to be somebody doing something to somebody, but, you know, even the lack of inclusion and people feeling isolated can be just as bad and just as harmful.
Right, definitely. And I think we speak about this actually on an upcoming episode about dissociative identity disorder, with how children are treated. The things they don't get can be just as important. So not getting social support, not getting certain care at home, you know, there's plenty that not getting can damage you in addition to actions that could be taken to your detriment.
Absolutely. And with the new school year upon us, absolutely, which I would like to say that we scheduled this episode because we knew that school was starting next week. Yeah, I think it's really important that we're raising awareness around bullying right now at the moment, as it is all the time, but massively at the moment.
Yeah, 100%. And the good news, the kind of silver lining potentially there, is that the mental health education we've been campaigning for comes into force in... Is force the wrong word? Education? comes into action from next month. It goes live in England and Wales. Obviously, the campaign goes on, and the link, as always, for our petition for mental health education is in the episode description, whilst we push for this to be extended to Scotland and Northern Ireland as well. But certainly, this is a major step forward, and it's come at a really good time. So many kids have been away from school for a prolonged period of time, and potentially will be more vulnerable socially. Because of that, we'll need a supportive school environment all the more. And so the fact that in their PSHE time with their like form tutor, there will now be these conversations around a basic understanding of mental health, including where to get support. And that will include, for the first time, a more robust and consistent signposting, including support for issues like bullying and isolation. So there's a really wonderful direct link here.
I've got to interrupt you at that point because it's just amazing the work that you've done and the podcast has been able to achieve. I just think it's absolutely amazing. I'm so excited, really, really proud and really, really pleased of the achievement.
No, it is really exciting. And I would have had things planned as well in terms of the rollout of this, but we're not really able to go to schools at the moment. So here we are. So delighted to be able to celebrate it here. And of course, thank you to all the listeners that have signed our petition for that campaign and continue to support. So yeah. So there's a definite silver lining and something I'm so proud to be a part of. And then one last stat, which I think really kind of hammers the relevance home, actually, is from charity Ditch the Label. They're an international charity supporting young people related to bullying. And they found in their last 2019 survey that 3 out of 4 people who were bullied said it affected their mental health, and nearly half became depressed as a result. And it's worth saying that whilst the link is particularly intense with depression, bullying does adversely affect every single mental health problem. And so that's where you can have this really dangerous cycle that so often those with existing mental health problems are targeted as one of the reasons they get bullied, which then affects their mental health. And then potentially they could be bullied more, or they could be more vulnerable in general. And we get that cycle very quickly, which the impact can be life-changing. And that's something you'll definitely hear in the interview today with Mark. You'll also hear in the interview how Mark's managed to triumph following these experiences, getting support with his mental health, and has now gone on to have an incredible career working in TV and film, including working on shows such as Stranger Things, The Walking Dead, and Dynasty. So I'm really excited for you all to hear Mark's experience. It's a fascinating insight into how extreme bullying can be and how it can affect a whole family. Is there anything you wanted to say before we get into it?
Yeah, only just that I thought he was really inspirational and a remarkable guy, you know, full of life and energy and really willing to open and share his really extreme and, as Bobby said, intense experience with us. So we're really grateful for him coming on and doing that. It's an amazing episode.
Brilliant. Well, we'll get into that interview with Mark Simon in a moment. But first, who's our sponsor? Let's find out.
Hi, Mark Simon. When I was a kid, I was very tight with my family. I had a great childhood. I mean, it was like the Leave It to Beaver. I was an only kid. I had everything I wanted, loving family. We had plenty of money. Everything was great. We never talked about mental health issues, other than we had one cousin on my dad's side who nothing was ever talked about as far as what it really was. It's just that she had problems. We just never talked about that kind of thing. So I didn't know what to expect if anything was to happen later.
Yeah. And I think that's a common experience for a lot of people. If it's not seen there being a need to have these conversations, then they don't happen. But of course, you can't predict what will happen in your life and what you may go through. And that's part of the challenge.
Yeah. And you know, we probably should have. I mean, my mom was afraid of a lot of things growing up. She was afraid of if I walked under a ladder. She was afraid of black cats. She was afraid of Friday the 13th. She was afraid of a lot of things, but we never talked about it really until I got older and you know, started talking about the fact that my grandfather, her father, had been murdered when I was 2 years old, that probably had something to do with it. Her brother abused her as far as not physically or anything, but just with pranks of things like he would throw snakes at her all the time. And she's definitely afraid of things like that. So I think a lot of that added up with her and why she was afraid of so many things. Obviously, she was afraid of water because her father was found floating upside down in the bayous of Louisiana. But we never talked about the mental aspects of any of that. But, you know, looking back, it's like, well, obviously, there are some issues going on there.
And even for you as a child growing up around that, there can be a lot of mental pressure and a feeling of unsafeness.
I could see where that would probably be. I was raised to have an incredibly oversized ego that I could do anything. And then my parents let me prove it. You know, give you an idea of my childhood. When I was 14, my dad made me superintendent of his custom home building company. So at 14, without a driver's license, they gave me a car. I would drive out to the job sites, tell all the guys what to do during the day, these giant muscular dudes. And then I would drive to junior high and park in the teacher's lot, since that's the only lot there was. Actually, I started my first business when I was 12. I had my own line of skateboards I designed and sold to Schwinn, the giant bike manufacturer. When I decided I wanted an office at the house, Dad said, go ahead and design it. So when I was 16, I designed an office, and he said, okay, now build it. So I added an addition onto our house for my own office. So it was not a normal childhood, but it was like anything you can think of, you can do. And they just supported me in everything. So yeah, Mom had her fearful issues, but from what I can tell, none of that affected my life at all. I mean, she wasn't sitting shivering in a corner. She was just, I don't want to go to the 13th floor. Or on Friday the 13th, we just laughed that, oh, mom's not going to leave the house today. Maybe we should have taken it more seriously, but it was just kind of a thing we just kind of laughed about. So for me, there was no mental issues that I can look back and seeing on my life growing up until I was in high school.
Right. And I imagine that instilled you with a real confidence, that way of upbringing.
Yeah.
And how did you find that then translated into the school environment?
The confidence I had, especially from telling all these really large construction guys who were 2, 3, 4 times my age at the time, it was very difficult to intimidate me. Now, to set the stage, when I was in high school, especially when I was a sophomore, or I guess a junior, I was like 5'4", 5'5", skinny kid, really muscular. But from what I wore, you wouldn't tell, because I worked my life in construction. So, you know, all I did, if I wasn't in school, was lifting heavy things constantly, you know, on building homes. So between knowing I was stronger than most people and telling big guys what to do and never backing down, even when they, you know, puffed up. Now, you got to do this. Just go over there, do it. A high school bully alone is not going to intimidate me. And there's this one kid, or there were a couple guys, it wasn't really a gang as far as a name, but there was just this gang of ruthless assholes that kind of ran rampant through my high school. And this was the largest high school in Texas at the time. We had 4,000 kids there. And Perry was the one who started everything with me. And, you know, they would tease me because I was short. Didn't bother me. You know, none of that kind of stuff bothered me. Like I said, a kid? What's a kid going to do to me? So it really started ramping up in gym class, where he was just an ass on the court and would body check people and run past them and punch the people and whatever he could to intimidate. And he would just run crazy. But then whenever he came and tried to body check me, I saw it coming. I just stood firm and he would bounce off me. Well, that embarrassed him, which made him now want to come after me harder. And then they would try teasing me and I would laugh in his face, which embarrassed him. And then 2 and 3 guys would come after me. And that just kept building, because all of a sudden this short kid is getting the best of him and everyone else is kowtowing to him because they were so afraid of getting hurt. And now these guys, it wasn't just regular bullying. I mean, they found one kid, saw them spray painting the outside of the school, chased him down and broke his thigh bone, his femur. They used to brag about throwing cinder blocks off of overpasses at the cars below. Not little stones, big cinder blocks. They were caught by the principal, because he told me, breaking into the school, crawling through the ceiling, and finding and burning their school records. So these are really bad, bad people. So a lot of people were afraid of them. I wasn't. Now, that led to all of this building up with my embarrassing them because I wouldn't back down. And I had a smart mouth. You know, when he would walk by and he'd say something, like, no one cares, Perry. No one else would say anything like that. I didn't care. I thought he was a jerk. Well, we were out at a party one night at a place we called the Back of Bammel. This is an area in Houston, Texas, near my school. It was an unfinished subdivision. The cul-de-sac surrounded by trees. No homes were there, just a finished road. We used to, every Saturday night, we'd build a big bonfire. Everyone would drive the cars back there. We'd park. Everyone would drink and hook up together. Big high school teenage party, right? Hormones are going everywhere. I had a 1963 T-Bird. So this was my car at the time. I had rebuilt it from the ground up. It was a beautiful vehicle. It was just a tank.
And I can vouch for it, listeners, because Mark is showing me a model of it.
Oh, I didn't. All right. So for anyone who can't see it, yeah. It was just a classic car, torpedo taillights, electric windows, and even though it was such an old car, it was the car of 1963. And I was back there talking to some girls right in front of the bonfire, and I was still sitting in my car, and all of a sudden I hear, hey, there's Simon, let's rumble. And instantly, everyone who was around my car was gone, and arms come in, and they start punching my buddy and I. I had a buddy in the passenger seat with me. And people are climbing up over the top of my car. They're swinging bats and chains at my car. They're punching us through the windows, pulling flaming boards out of the bonfire and coming after us. And it was the most frightening moment of my life. Now, I had a number of them since then with the same group of people. But if you can imagine 30 people all of a sudden attacking you out of the blue with any kind of hand weapon, luckily they didn't have guns with them. So we lean away, and I grab Perry's arm. You know, Perry, the guy that I was having problems with in gym class and around the school, was the one punching me through the window. So I grabbed his arm with one hand while rolling up the window with the other. My buddy rolled up his window so he was safe, and I see this guy on top of the car about to swing a baseball bat down at my windshield. I put the car in gear, and I just floored it. I took off. So everyone on top of the car went flying off. So now I'm driving like a demon up this tiny road. Both sides are packed with pickup trucks and cars and people roaming around half drunk. They're all jumping out of the way, not knowing what's going on. And one of his buddies jumps out in front of my car to try to make me stop, which was not a good idea. He rolled off the side, and I drove on. But I missed the exit. There was only one exit out of this place. And in my fear, I missed it. I spun my car around, tried to get back to the exit, but they had pulled up two other vehicles and blocked it. Now more people pulled flaming boards out of the bonfire, pulled more weapons out of their trucks. Remember, this is Texas. No matter where you are, everyone hears about Texas cowboys. Everything you've heard bad about Texas happens in Texas.
Oh, dear.
And so I literally felt like the Frankenstein monster. You know, we've all seen that image of the monster and all the villagers with their torches and pitchforks and whatever hand weapons they could find marching up the street towards him. Well, that's what I was seeing through my windshield at that moment. And my blood just ran cold in my veins. I was instantly drenched. You know how when something happens and all of a sudden every pore releases sweat on your body? That's what happened to me. And my buddy just looked at me and just screamed, "Mark!" So I said, "Hold on." I dropped my car into first and hopped the curb. And I couldn't get back to the main road directly because there was a brick fence on one side keeping us from getting to the exit. And there was a ditch between us and the main road. In a lot of areas, you know, they have drainage ditches along both sides of the road. Luckily, they had just carved out that drainage ditch. And so that meant there was dirt piled up on either side. I hit that pile of dirt with my ancient 1963 car, and it launched my car into the air over the ditch. And I landed in the middle of a busy road and spun out. Cars are spinning all over trying to miss me. Luckily, they all did. And we took off. I dropped my buddy off around the corner from my house where he lived. I went in, and every night I would stop and talk to my parents. Their bedroom was right next to the side door that I would always enter in through. And I would always tell them, "Hey, I met up with these people. This is what we did. You know, just hang out." It was the last thing I did is talk to my parents. And before I could tell them what had happened, we hear a bunch of noise in front of the house. My mom goes out first, again, having no idea what was going on. I look out, and I see it's four of the guys from the gang. Steve and Perry and two other guys. And I run back in. My dad's just in his robe, doesn't have his glasses on or anything, and he's barefoot. And I said, "Dad, they're here. They're around Mom." He runs out, again, not knowing what's going on, and sees the guys around Mom. The guys say, "Here comes the old man." They tried to leave. They jumped in the pickup truck. Dad, barefoot, ran after him. And my dad was an old farm boy who then built homes. Chased the truck, grabbed one of the guys by one arm, picked him up out of the pickup truck. "What the hell's going on here?" The rest of the guys jump out of the truck. So Steve was the one my dad grabbed. So Steve starts spitting at my dad, punching him, slapping him, screaming at him, cursing at him, threatening to kill me, threatening to kill my mom, said they're going to firebomb the house. I mean, just horrific stuff, cursing like you wouldn't believe at him in this litany of 10 or 15 minutes. In the meantime, one of the guys comes out, starts knocking me up against a tree. I'm totally freaking out. I don't know what's going on. I'm not even protecting myself. And I'm looking in against another tree, two other guys are slapping my mom around in our front yard. My dad didn't know what to do to protect the family, didn't know why they were making these threats. He was out in the street, didn't know what he could do.
And so at that point, your dad's not fought back? He doesn't want to hurt anyone
at all.
They're around you and your mom as well. How did that particular incident end?
Dad didn't realize what was happening to mom and I. He was so consumed with Steve. But there was so much screaming and yelling, the neighbors heard it. Most of them did not want to get involved. But one neighbor across the street called the cops. Her boyfriend, he was 22, 23, big guy, his name was Kyle, came out swinging a 4-foot pipe, metal pipe. And he helped chase the guys away. So we just called the cops. They're on their way. And the kid said, "We're going to come back and kill you." He goes, "Punk, you don't know who I am. You know, I'd rather beep you than look at you." So that's how that went. When they heard the cops are coming, the other three guys left my mom and I, grabbed Steve, jumped in the truck, and took off. Cops showed up 5 minutes later. So that's when they started telling us what some of our options were. We didn't want to go through juvenile justice because that doesn't do a whole lot. We wanted something that would be permanent. So one of the constables, who was a friend of all the kids in the area, his name's Officer Ogden, told me about a new law that had never been used before. It was a law that would hold parents responsible for the actions of their kids. And we said, that sounds great. So we met with the judge, and the judge told us, in order for this to work, we have to bring the families in, warn them in court, and give them the opportunity to control their kids. That way, when we have them arrested, they can't say, "I didn't know little Johnny was doing that. How would I know?" There was a process.
Hmm.
Within a week, that judge set up a Saturday meeting with the families of the four kids that attacked my family. We warned them. Two of the families dealt with it instantly. One of them smacked his kid in the back of the head, said, "Don't you ever even look sideways at that Simon kid again. Don't do this to me." One kid had been a friend of mine. He just got wrapped up in it. He came over and apologized. I accepted it. And then the other two, Steve and Perry, only had their mothers. One of those mothers, in that court trial, in that court warning, called me a pussy in front of the judge. She said, "Those boys should just deal with this on their own. If your son is too much of a pussy looking at my family to deal with it, he's on his own." You could see where the problems came from, among, you know, other possibles.
And I'm interested to hear more about what happened from there. But in terms of checking in on how you and your family were feeling at this point, what was the initial impact emotionally?
Emotionally, it was hardest on my mom. Dad always rose to the occasion. Because we went through 2 or 3 months of attacks, you know, from that point on. He was a real tough individual. He'd get steely-eyed and would just deal with it. If the courts didn't work, Dad was going to take care of it. Mom would break down and cry all the time. But she also became really strong. We hadn't really owned guns. My dad had one that we used to go shooting with every once in a while. But the whole family bought guns as protection. We all went out and got trained. My mom became Annie Oakley, the sharpshooter woman from the Wild West. Every time we went out, she would hit bullseye, 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 because she had a reason to. She used to follow me whenever I drove to school and whenever I would leave school to come home. She would be in her car with a gun next to her to watch over me to make sure everything was okay. So she was frightened and would break down, except in moments where she felt she had to protect me, she would always rise to the occasion. Me, at that point, I was afraid, but I wasn't changing my life at all. I refused to let them affect my life. I didn't do anything wrong. They did. They should be the ones to suffer, not me. But I was afraid. I mean, I'm not stupid. I was afraid. But the issues I ran into, it took a few months of that before I had my big breakdown.
Right. And do you mind sharing what kind of issues led to that?
Yeah. So they had attacked me a number of different ways, between driving me off the road, breaking into other people's locked homes to attack me. I was always able to fend for myself and was able to get away without being hurt. But I was on a date after a couple months of all this. I was on a date, the girl who didn't know anything about what had been going on, one of the few people who would talk to me at the time, and they saw me on the date, and 8 of them came after me. I barely got out away from them. I hopped in my car and drove away before they could get to me. They were running me down, 8 of them, bats, chains, tire irons, the works.
And where was the girl in this?
She didn't know what was going on. We were in front of her house throwing a frisbee. And I said, I have to go. And just left. And once I calmed down a while later, I called her and tried to explain it as well as I could. I said, are you okay? She goes, yeah. They just glared at me and turned and walked away. But she wouldn't ever see me again after that. But that incident, culminating after months of being assaulted and beaten by these guys, that's when we finally called the cops, said, all right, that's it. That's a point of no return. We had the parents arrested. But when I drove away, I lost my mind. I had a nervous breakdown at that moment, and I didn't know where I was. I drove around Houston mindlessly. It was, if you've ever taken a long drive and you've been driving for 3, 4, 5 hours, long stretch of road, and you get that tunnel vision where everything goes down to a pinpoint. That's all I could see was a pinpoint in front of me. There was no peripheral vision whatsoever. I'm crying. I'm sweating. I'm going back and forth between breathing heavy to punching the ceiling of my car, to crying again, to wheezing. It was a cavalcade of every possible emotion was going through my body. And I literally had no idea where I was. I don't know how long I was driving around. It was hours.
And so did you feel you had to keep driving to feel safe in that moment?
Yeah. The whole area, there was a lot of them. So if I was anywhere near where I lived or shopped or whatever, I figured they could see me. So I just drove places I didn't even know. After a few hours, I end up over at an old friend's house who had moved to a different area of town. And I showed up at his place. I couldn't even talk to him. I just said, I have to use your phone. This is because this is 1980. So this is long before cell phones existed. I called my parents. I said, that's it. They came after me again. They said, where are you? I said, I'm at Johnny's. I'll be home when I can. And that was all I could say. My buddy Johnny asked me a couple things. I literally couldn't talk to him. In fact, it was, now looking back, it was kind of funny that his dad, who was a really big, rotund guy, just Texan through and through, a bully himself, came out and saw me really frustrated. And he goes, what's going on, little guy? Helpful. And I said something, mumbled something about, you know, some guys just attacked me or, you know, bullying me, whatever it was I said. And he said, quit being such a pussy. Again, same term. Said, just punch him in the nose and it'll be over. It's like, no, that's not how this works. Johnny, I got to go. And I just left. So I drove home and I just walked past my parents. I couldn't even talk to them. I just walked straight up to my room, collapsed on the floor and just cried through the night and passed out on the floor. You know, by the morning, I could talk and I could think, but I wasn't myself. I had one friend who that night came over. The only guy who would, at that point, would still talk to me. His name was Jim, still my best friend to this day. He came over and just sat with me. Years later, I interviewed him about his involvement and what was going on, trying to remember everything. And he said, yeah, he said, it wasn't you. He said, the cocky Mark was gone, you know. Normally you were take control of every situation. And he said, you just kind of sat there and just kind of nodded, you know, whatever you guys want to do. So, you know, my family and Jim, you know, again, protected the house. We had cops were patrolling outside of our house. We had private security at that point. And I just kind of wandered around like a shell of myself. And it took probably 2 or 3 days before I was kind of acting normal. What I didn't realize was that was the start of PTSD. I didn't know for years what it was. I knew what I was reacting to. I knew that any sound behind me, I would jerk. I'd break it into an instant sweat. I was always afraid of a knife plunging into my back. If I wasn't looking, I had to sit with my back against walls. I couldn't sit in an open movie theater. I had to sit in the back row. I didn't know what any of this meant. We didn't talk about any of that. That was not a... It was, how do we protect ourselves? Not protect ourselves mentally. It's like, how do we not die? That was our discussion at the house. If someone firebombs a house, where's our escape plan? If they burst in through the front or the side door, how do we get out? That was our daily talk at my house at that point. You know, again, I went from literally living the life of luxury in every way to talking about how to survive till morning. For months.
Yeah. And in your own house as well.
Yeah. It was absolutely frightening.
Yeah, I can 100% see that. And one thing I just want to pick up on there, you mentioned about then there being police patrols around you by that point.
Yeah.
Was there no offer of that kind of protection prior, given the extent of these attacks?
Yeah, they had actually started patrolling the house after the initial incident. And it was on and off for about the first week. There was quite a bit. But they said, look, but we can't plant someone here. So they gave us the name of someone they trusted, a private eye. Even my dad doesn't remember anymore. But he would park two houses away and came and ran people off if they came and slowed down in front of our house. But, you know, we couldn't afford to have private security 24/7. We didn't have that kind of money. So, you know, the cops would come by, and then it got heavier patrols when big things would happen. Like the night that we had the two ringleaders' parents arrested and thrown in jail. There was a lot of fear that night. Nothing happened to us, but we didn't know that. You know, the threats were coming. We heard the threats, but luckily nothing happened. And I don't know if they tried and got run off. We just don't know.
May I ask how those threats were coming to you?
It was a combination of things. There were notes left on our cars. There were threats given to other people who knew us, who would then call us. The school administrators would overhear things and would call my family saying, look, we heard that they're planning on firebombing your house tonight. Officer Ogden would hear from other kids, you know, because he would always hang out at the local McDonald's. That was a big hangout for us. And he would hear things and would tell me or call my family. So it was a few different things. I mean, and there were times that they would wrap notes around bricks and throw it through people's windshields as warnings to avoid me. So, I mean, it was a lot like a movie. You know, the old Walking Tall movie type of thing, yeah.
Indeed. Well, I even thought that when you were describing the incident on the building estate, it almost sounded like something out of Walking Dead, which, of course, foreshadows the kind of work you're involved in now. But the reason I'm so interested in hearing about these threats is because I think that's something that a lot of people overlook, actually. The fact that one of the limitations of the human brain is we're not very good at distinguishing between threat of violence in front of us and threat of violence that we're feeling internally. And that's a lot of why we can have such prevalence of anxiety conditions, of which PTSD is one of them, because these are reactions that evolved in us in order to run from predators or find immediate safety. But nowadays, we can be made to feel unsafe in so many ways, hence why I would imagine what you experienced would have had such an online component if it were to happen today. And then how do you escape from that constant fear when it's in your phone in your hand? Then it's
constantly. Well, you know, that's really interesting what you just brought up, because I'm sure there was anxiety going on. I didn't know anything about what anxiety meant at the time. I do now. My wife suffers from anxiety, so I've been able to help her through it. But at the time, my mom was the one suffering the most. But when you were talking about the difference between danger in front of you versus danger that you're being told, I dealt better when the guys were in front of me because I can see it.
Mm-hmm.
The thought of danger, the threats coming in that they were going to kill me or going to kill my mom or going to firebomb the house was much worse because your mind won't stop. A physical thing of them in front of me, I know it's happening at that moment. What I don't know was more frightening. And it's the worrying and the fear of what could happen was much worse, much longer lasting. Because if they were attacking me within a few minutes, it was going to be over. But if it was just a threat hanging in the air, that doesn't go away. Do you live with that? And your mind does that cycling over and over and over. And there is nothing worse than getting into that dreaded cycle of dread.
Yeah, absolutely. That there's something fundamentally finite about a physical threat, that is by no way belittling it, but it's very difficult for that threat to be the level to which you can imagine, because you can imagine anything. And in your case, you had every right to imagine all kinds of threats. You had every justification to imagine the very worst.
Yeah, not only from what had already happened to me, but things I knew had been happening to other people. So, yeah, it was horrendous. And what's been interesting about this, especially because, you know, for years afterwards, you know, I was having that whole bit of looking over my shoulder, always the fear of someone was behind me. It was just unbelievable dread. I'm trying to think of how long it was, maybe 15 years after the court trial was when I was able to stop looking over my shoulder. And this is what I always tell people. Your mind is your best friend and your worst enemy. Your mind will keep running things over and over and over. So when I first wrote the story down, I tried writing as a book or as a script a long, long time ago, but my ability to tell a story that way wasn't very good. But it didn't matter. Fact is, I wrote it down. And when I got to the end, and I wrote down every single detail, when I got to the end and I wrote the words, the end, it was like I had flushed everything out of my body. My mind no longer had to remember it because it was in writing. I literally put it down. It's kind of like having a to-do list for work. If you know you've got 5 things to do tomorrow, but you don't write it down, you're not going to sleep well because your mind is going over, oh, I have to do this. I have to call Jim. I have to call her. I have to do this. But if you have a to-do list, you can sleep comfortably because you don't have to remember anything. It's there in writing. When you wake up in the morning, you just look at it and you get done what you need to. So that process of writing it down flushed all the anxiety out of my body. From that moment on, I hadn't had a bad dream or a bad night's sleep from the moment I wrote the end.
Wow. And that makes a lot of sense, really, because it is a kind of trap we can fall into where it feels like we're being productive, these things going over and over. And very much that's a symptom of the PTSD, that it's difficult not to keep reliving these experiences, often in a very full body, all-encompassing way. And yet somehow it feels like a route to safety, because if I just keep thinking about it, maybe I'll figure out how this happened to me and how I can escape it.
Yeah, and that doesn't work. Your mind going around, all it does is you keep reliving the fear and the pain, and that doesn't help you.
And so then in terms of things that were trying to help, so that court case, what was the outcome there?
That was awesome. Like the judge worked very quickly. Within a couple of weeks when we had the parents arrested, we had the court trial. And we were third or fourth up that morning. It was just two of the families. We brought up, we had 4 counts of whatever it was against each of the families. We brought up into court 2 each so we could leave 2 outstanding. And I needed something over their heads so they wouldn't turn around and try to get retribution. So we get into court and we win the first case against the first family. Basically, it got down to the one woman's attorney who she evidently was sleeping with instead of paying him. We found that out from the local constable. So we were right at the verge of everything ending when the mother was brought up and he asked her a few questions. Did you tell Steve that he could attack the Simon boy? No, I did not. Do you think it's okay that he's had been attacking? No, of course I don't. Are you proud of your son? And the courtroom goes silent. I mean, it was like a moment out of a movie. I looked over at my dad and went, we just won this court case, didn't we? And he just nodded and smiled. Because that is the question that's kind of like, have you stopped beating your wife yet? There is no good answer. Either, yes, I stopped beating my wife, which meant I had been, or no, I've not stopped beating my wife, which means I still am. Are you proud of your son? Yes, I'm proud means I think it's okay what he's doing to the Simon family. Or no, I'm not proud of my son means I can't control him and I know what he's doing. So she just started crying. She couldn't answer. She just broke down into tears. The judge stopped the case and said guilty. And the other family, the other mother just pled no contest. She goes, I don't want to go through this. Pled no contest. And they were led back to jail. And that was it. As far as all the ringleaders and the main gang, I literally never saw them again. They were kicked out of the school, kicked out of the school district. They never showed their face in our area, anywhere where I was. I literally never saw them again. The only thing that happened after that, it was about 2 weeks after that, people are finally talking to me again, and I'm finally able to concentrate on school because I had failed an advanced math class during all of that because I couldn't concentrate, which was really unusual. I was a mathlete in junior high and high school. And here I am failing math, obvious reasons. I mean, I literally just couldn't think. But my life is starting to come back. I'm going up this huge stairwell at my school. Again, it's a gigantic school. Going up the stairwell, and I get smacked from behind, full body check, into a concrete wall. My books go flying everywhere. I hit face first into this concrete wall. These four gorilla-sized hands grab me, spin me around, slam my back up against the wall, and these two huge guys I have never seen before get in my face, cursing, threatening, lean in close to me. What are you going to do, Simon? What are you going to do? Huh? You going to have our parents arrested too? Now, at the moment they slam me against the wall, everything goes tipsy-turvy. Again, I get that pinpoint vision. I break an instant sweat. I can't tell up from down. I'm literally all over the place. I feel like I'm dizzy. Until I heard them say, you going to have our parents arrested too? An instant calm came over me. It's like someone just wiped everything clean, and I leaned in, and I leaned right up into their faces, at which point their eyes started getting kind of wide, and I looked at them, and with a big smile, I said, yeah, and they just both took two steps back away from me in shock and just stood there, picked up my books, hopped up the stairs, never had another problem with anyone again.
Wow.
So the court trial emboldened me too. I knew that no one could compete with me if I brought them up to my level.
Right. And it's so difficult to wrap your head around what you'd been through. So it therefore makes sense that going through the court system and having that confirmation that you hadn't caused this, that you weren't in the wrong, must have been so powerful.
Yeah, luckily, that's a really good point, because there's a lot of victim blaming in our society, in every country. None of that was happening around me. Luckily, so I didn't feel any of that, because that's nasty inside your body. That's something that you really can't get over without professional help. I didn't have any of that. Thank goodness. You know, if you look at a headline, it says woman raped in this area. Well, it's like, well, that's victim blaming. Why are we talking about the woman? Why don't we talk about the guy, the man that raped her? Why not so-and-so man raped a woman? Let's stop putting the focus on the victims and put the focus on the assholes who are doing the problems. Luckily, I didn't have that problem. The focus was always on them. So, the court trial helped me. So, you know, my confidence was coming back. What I didn't realize for a long, long time was that fear of always someone coming up behind me. That was the thing that took a long, long time to get over.
Of course, I can imagine. And in addition to writing out what you lived through and finding that outlet to get it out of circling in your head, what else did you find that helped?
Being open about it. During the attacks, and we were planning on the court trial, there were four other families I knew had been attacked, or at least their kids had been attacked. And I found out who and where they were. I went to each of their homes and had doors slammed in my face. They didn't want to talk to me. They were afraid. Wouldn't help me, even though it would help them. Businesses wouldn't talk to me because these guys had caused a lot of harm and problems with vandalism or attacking patrons. No one would talk to me. So I felt really alone, except for my family and Jim, my best friend. After the court trial and we won, I went back to each of those families. And before I let them slam the door in my face again, I said, I won. I want to show you how. And the door stayed open. So I taught each of those four families what they needed to do to use the courts the way I did. And then I went to seven local businesses and I talked to the managers, who then spoke with me as well, because I'd already won. I'd already done the hard part. So now people are willing to listen. So I showed them what they needed to do. And then I was deputized for my work on getting rid of the gang. So that helped a lot. That was very empowering to feel like now I had control. I was being proactive and being able to do something. So that gave me that sense of worth and strength that had been ripped away from me during all the threats and all the attacks. So that helped a lot. What got my life back the quickest was theater. The theater kids in high school, I had never seen a play. I didn't know anything about theater. My parents never went, so I was never exposed to it. But when I failed that math class that I mentioned, I took up an extra class of art. I was always an artist. I was always the artist at school. You know, I was winning all the awards, and I drew for the paper and drew for the yearbooks and whatnot. So my teacher said, look, since you have this extra period, why don't you go help the theater department? They need brochures and posters for the new play, which at the time was Fiddler on the Roof. And I said, sure, I'll go down there. So I would sit on the edge of the stage, and I would be sketching out ideas and watching them build the sets. Well, I build homes for a living. So I kept making comments. You know, build it this way, it's easier. That's a stronger way of doing this. You know, why don't you do this? And that kind of built to then my end up redesigning the sets. And then I ended up building the main sets. And then I ended up being backstage manager all on my first play. Because theater and band were all on one end of the school, they didn't know what had happened. So no one there had been prejudiced against me for fear of what might happen if they talked to me. So now I'm in this group of people who are unbelievably creative, unbelievably fun, open to me because they didn't know to be afraid of being around me. And I was good at it. So now I can cut loose, feel totally confident. None of the people in any of the gang were ever in the theater area because it was literally a different area of the school. It was a freedom and sensation that opened me up into new things that I didn't even know existed in this world. That got me back really quickly into living a life that I enjoyed again. So I completely credit all my theater buddies for getting my life back.
That's incredible. It sounds like it was the new start that you so needed.
Yeah, and it led me to what I do now. I mean, there's a direct line from that, because from that summer, the court trial and the attacks were in the fall. Spring, I got into theater. That summer, I went to a theater camp at Stephen F. Austin State University. My senior year, that university offered me a scholarship in theater to go there. I accepted it. I went to SFA. I ended up majoring in film. I graduated and thought, hey, Hollywood sounds cool, and I moved to Hollywood and started my career. So, I mean, it was a direct line from needing a new place in school to live to what I now love as my career.
Yeah, I love that. And beyond that, you're also now working to empower other people with your story via the book you wrote.
Yeah. So you cover there, Attacked. We're celebrating this year, it's 40 years since the attack and in the court trial. And it's not that I felt I had to wait this long. I tried writing this a number of times. I just didn't feel my abilities were doing it justice. So I just kept rewriting it over the years. And look, I stay busy. The only reason I was able to finish now is because of the COVID shutdown. Because I work on the biggest shows and biggest movies. So I work every day and every night. But now all of a sudden I had all this free time and I was able to finish the book and get it out. So now I feel good about it. It's a good story. It's told in a way that I feel a lot of pride with the way it turned out. And then I've got a number of epilogues in the back. I've got one on my advice on how to deal with bullies. I've got another one on how I got over my PTSD, you know, trying to help other people. So there's a number of different things in the back that I'm trying to help people who've gone through. While they might not have been, a lot of people aren't attacked as badly as I am, bullying hits your mind and hits your soul, and it will affect everybody. You don't have to have your life threatened to feel like your life is threatened. So I understand that anyone who's bullied can be hurt tremendously on the inside. So I'm using the story to guide people, hopefully, into then reading the other things I have in back to see hopefully if that'll help them get through it.
I would imagine it certainly will. And it's so impressive that you found that, but it's also sounds like a sense of closure you found in finally not just externalizing the writing of it, but now you're putting it out back into the world, because it was ultimately other people's problems to begin with that they were taking out on you. And now you've pushed them back out of your house again.
You know, it's interesting you say that. One of the things that's been really amazing is as the book has been coming out, and it hasn't been out that long yet, a lot of people have been writing to me about what they had gone through and how this helped them. But in particular, a number of people reached out to me who had been attacked by the same guys, and they have never spoken about it.
Sure.
And it's given them a catharsis, and it's given them a release that 40 years they lived with and could never talk about it because they were afraid. It was my book that allowed them to open up, reach out to me, and talk about their story.
Yeah. I'm not surprised there's such power in owning your story in that way. You know, we find that time and time again with pretty much every guest we ever speak to.
I love that. Owning your story. I'm going to use that. I'm going to steal that from you. I do. I absolutely love that because you're right. You know, one of the reasons I didn't leave my high school because my principal and vice principal had offered, look, any school will want you because my GPA was so high. We can place you anywhere for safety. And I told him, I said, why should I uproot my life? They're the bad people. And I refused to back down as hard as it was on me. So I owned it and I'm owning the story now. And if it makes them feel bad, I don't give a shit. You know, however they feel, they've got to live with. They did it. There's no victim blaming here. I'm owning the story. It's a good story, and I want everyone else to be able to beat the assholes in their lives, too.
What a great message to end on. So we'll wrap up there. Thank you so much for joining us and sharing your experience.
I appreciate the time. Thanks.
And listeners, if you want to go check out Mark's book called Attacked, you can find the link for that in the episode description. Thank you for listening. For a list of our recommended resources, visit mentalpodcast.co.uk. And remember, we are in no way a substitute for qualified counselling or other mental health support. Our show is edited and produced by the brilliant Pete Murta, with licensed music by NetSky. Links in the description. Speak to you next Thursday, and remember, you are enough.